In your Bibles, 2 Chronicles chapter 20, that's where we'll be taking our study from this evening. For the college students who have not been in this class, we've been working our way through a study of prayer by considering various prayers that we find in the Bible and studying them in their context, getting a little bit of the background of what's going on in that story, talking about the prayer itself and what it says, and then trying to draw some lessons for our prayer life today out of these prayers. So that's what we've been doing, and today we are to Jehoshaphat's prayer in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, which, if you're anything like me, is not a biblical prayer you think about a whole lot. This was actually the one that when I compiled my list and thought I had everything that I wanted to cover, I dropped by Tom's office and said, "Is there anything I'm missing?" And he said, "Jehoshaphat's prayer," and I thought, "I have no idea what that is." And so I went and I looked at it, added it to the list, and when I came back to it to study it, I found that it is truly a remarkable prayer, I think, in the Bible. And I'm glad we'll be taking the time to look at it today. The context, to just kind of jump into where we are in the text here and get something of an idea of what's going on when you come to Jehoshaphat's prayer. Remember, of course, Jehoshaphat is a good king of Judah. This is after the northern and southern tribes have split off. Israel to the north, the 10 tribes, Judah to the south, the 2 tribes. Judah still has the Davidic line reigning on the throne. The northern kingdom, they have basically have one evil king after another. It's not all the same dynasty. Every now and then someone will come up and usurp the dynasty, and that new dynasty will last for a while and just keeps on going like that very wickedly. The south is always the Davidic line still, but they're not all good kings. In fact, the vast majority of them are bad kings as well. But there are a few good ones. Jehoshaphat is among them. If you were to go through and try to quantify the goodness of the kings, not that that's really something we could do, but just hypothetically, I'd say Jehoshaphat probably is among the top 5 of the good kings of the southern kingdom. But that's just my judgment, obviously. But he's a good king. He's not a perfect king. And in particular, his great failing is in his alliance with Ahab, who is a name you probably know better than most of the southern kings. He was a king of the north who was married to Jezebel, who brought her idolatry in, and he went hook, line, and sinker along with it. That's during the time of Elijah and Elisha, of course. And Jehoshaphat, a good king of the south, decides to make an alliance with Ahab, the terribly wicked king of the north. And it's not a good thing at all for him to be joining in with someone like that. It has very long-lasting detrimental impacts on his family. His kids don't turn out great, in part because of their relation to Ahab's family. And that's well outside of our scope for today, except to just kind of get a fuller picture of Jehoshaphat's life. And in particular, in chapter 18 is where we find him making this alliance with Ahab. Chapter 19, he kind of turns a little bit, and there's the picture of his reforms. Not that he was a wicked king in chapter 18, but chapter 19 really focuses on the positive. And here, in contrast to the alliance with Ahab in chapter 20, now what we have is a picture of his reliance on God, that this situation is so bad, he turns to God and puts his complete hope and confidence in God and what God can do. Particularly what happens is he is suddenly surrounded by enemies, so to speak. There is this invasion that happens, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 20. After this, the Moabites and the Ammonites, and with them some of the Munites, came against Jehoshaphat for battle. Some men came and told Jehoshaphat, "A great multitude is coming against you from Edom, from beyond the sea, and behold, they are in Hazazon Tamar," that is, in Gedi. Then Jehoshaphat was afraid and set his face to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And Judah assembled to seek help from the Lord. From all the cities of Judah they came to seek the Lord. And that kind of gives us the backdrop for this prayer that is going to be said really in verses 5 through 12 is the content of the prayer itself. The first thing about this context and the invasion of these enemies is the way it begins, which is this phrase, "After this, the Moabites and the Ammonites and these other people came into Judah. And that phrase obviously sets it within a historical context of itself, and that historical context is what had just happened, obviously. After this, what had just happened, and the all of chapter 19 is the backdrop to that, and that is, again, Jehoshaphat's reforms, him turning to God and him setting up worship of God and all of these good things that he has done. After this, these bad people come and cause him trouble. And it's kind of a non sequitur almost in the text that you expect after all of these good things he's done, that what's going to happen is God's going to bless him and everything's going to be great in his kingdom. But instead, after this, bad things happen instead. And it's the same kind of thing that you see over in chapter 32 as well, where really picking up in chapter 31, Hezekiah is doing very good things and he is establishing worship of God. Verse 20 of chapter 31, Hezekiah did throughout all Judah, and he did what was good and right and faithful before the Lord in every work that he undertook in the service of the house of God, and in accordance with the law and the commandment, seeking his God, he did with all his heart and prospered. After these things and these acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah. And it's the same kind of scenario there as well, where God is apparently testing these kings in their faithfulness to see just how faithful they are. And what you find is these kings turning to God and showing that they are still dependent on him, even in the midst of these trials. The groups that are listed, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, you know very well. The other group, the Meunites, depending on your translation, some of yours may say some other Ammonites. We don't know exactly who those people are. They're a group that in other places are linked with the Arabs in chapter 17 and chapter 26. It's really not that big of a deal to locate them with any kind of precision. They've come from beyond the sea, it says. The sea there in context is the Dead Sea. Some understand that as coming across the sea in a very literal kind of way. And if that is what's going on, these were not seafaring people. They didn't build ships and sail across the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea in the southern portion is extremely shallow. It would have meant that probably that they forded the sea and came directly over that way, but it could just refer to them having come from the other side. And they come, and there is a great multitude of them, the text tells us. And if you know anything about the Bible and about warfare in the Bible and God going to battle for his people, you know that if you're on the other side and there's a great multitude of you, that's bad news for you. Because over and over and over and over in the biblical text, God's people are outnumbered, and they're outnumbered not just by a little. They're outnumbered by a great multitude. And that phrase itself shows up in a lot of these battles where God comes and does war for his people and brings them to some kind of salvation. So you get here, even at the outset, just a hint of what's going to be coming as long as Jehoshaphat is faithful. And that's, of course, what you're going to find in this story as well. Especially when, right on the heels of that, we find him seeking God. Yeah, he set his face to seek the Lord, it says in verse 3. He proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah, and Judah assembled to seek help from the Lord. So twice in these two verses we're told that he is seeking, or he is leading the people in seeking after God. And this is something of a key word in Jehoshaphat's reign. It comes up in chapter 17, chapter 18, and chapter 19 as well. Now it shows up twice in chapter 20. It has, in Jehoshaphat's context, it really kind of has the basic sense of worshiping God, though certainly it also includes the idea of discovering what God's will in a matter is. And really what it's showing us here at the outset of this story is that his ultimate trust is not in his military resources, but in God. And he is obviously rightly seeing the temple itself. This is where he is, seeing the temple as the place to seek after God, as opposed to what some of the other kings did in the high places and such. So that kind of paints even more of the picture of him as this good king, this good leader of Judah. Well, that's the basic context of the prayer. Obviously, that's not a full discussion of all of it, but that'll give us at least enough of a good idea of what's going on that we can proceed. But any questions or comments or anything about this kind of backdrop before we look at the prayer itself? Okay, well, continuing then in verse 5. And Jehoshaphat stood in the assembly of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of the Lord before the new court and said, O Lord God of our fathers, Are you not God in heaven? You rule over all the kingdoms of the nations. In your hand are power and might, so that none is able to withstand you. Did you not, our God, drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel, and give it forever to the descendants of Abraham, your friend? And they have lived in it, and have built for you in it a sanctuary for your name, saying, if disaster comes upon us, the sword, judgment, or pestilence, or famine, we will stand before this house and before you, for your name is in this house, and cry out to you in our affliction, and you will hear and save. And now, behold, the men of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom you would not let Israel invade when they came from the land of Egypt, and whom they avoided and did not destroy, behold, they reward us by coming to drive us out of your possession, which you have given us to inherit. And, O our God, will you not execute judgment on them? For we are powerless against this great horde that is coming against us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. And what will happen then is the Spirit of the Lord will come on Jehaziel in verse 14, and he will respond with God's message in verse 15, which is, listen, all Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem and King Jehoshaphat, thus says the Lord to you, do not be afraid and do not be dismayed at this great horde, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow go down against them. Behold, they will come up by the ascent of Ziz. You will find them at the end of the valley, east of the wilderness of Jeruel. You will not need to fight in this battle. Stand firm, hold your position, and see the salvation of the Lord on your behalf, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not be afraid and do not be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, and the Lord will be with you. Then Jehoshaphat bowed his head with his face to the ground, and all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem fell down before the Lord, worshiping the Lord. And the Levites of the Kohathites and the Korahites stood up to praise the Lord, the God of Israel, with a very loud voice. And they rose early in the morning and went out into the wilderness of Tekoa. And when they went out, Jehoshaphat stood and said, hear me, Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem. Believe in the Lord your God, and you will be established. Believe his prophets, and you will succeed. And when he had taken counsel with the people, he appointed those who were to sing to the Lord and praise him in holy attire as they went before his army and say, give thanks to the Lord, for his steadfast love endures forever. And what you find as you continue in the story is this is one of those scenes where God uses the opposing armies to destroy themselves, and the different factions apparently somehow got confused and fought against one another and delivered Judah in that kind of way. So that's the prayer and kind of the results of the prayer as well. The prayer itself really could be broken down into four basic parts. There are four things that Jehoshaphat does in this prayer. He begins by praising God for his sovereign power. And this is, of course, especially appropriate in the circumstance for him to begin by praising God for his power, because what he knows about himself is that he is utterly powerless. He has some kind of army. We don't know what it is, but he understands that it's not going to do the job by itself. So for all intents and purposes, he's got no power whatsoever. So he turns to the one who does have the power, and that is God, of course. And this is a very common theme also that runs through Chronicles. You find it in one of David's prayers as well. In 1 Chronicles chapter 29, back there in verse 12, both riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all. In your hand are power and might, and in your hand is to make great and to give strength to all. And it's the same thing that you find Jehoshaphat saying here. In your hand are power and might. And it's just this repeated theme that God is ultimately the source of all power. This picture of God ruling over the nations is something that also comes up back in 1 Chronicles chapter 29. We also see it in 2 Chronicles chapter 17 and 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Of course, it's a very common theme throughout the prophets, whether it's the book of Daniel, which is really about God ruling over the nations, or the other prophets where God just shows that he rules over them by saying he's going to judge them one after the other. That theme is here as well, which again is especially appropriate concerning the circumstances, or considering the circumstances. You rule over the kingdoms of the nations, he says in verse 6. Well, That's extremely appropriate because the kingdoms of the nations are coming to do war against Jehoshaphat and his nation. So he begins with two very thoughtful kinds of things. I mean, he's not just going to God and praising God in general because he's God and he deserves to be praised, although there, of course, is a time and a place for that. His praise is very well thought out. He's praising God for his power when he is powerless. He's praising God for his rule over the nations when the nations are coming to do something bad to God's anointed one. And so there is something that's very, very appropriate about the way that this prayer begins in praise. Secondly, there is the praise for the gift of the land and the temple. God has promised to give these things, and God has given them. God has given them even this place to worship Him. And this is a series of rhetorical questions that come through here. And the purpose of the rhetorical questions, did you not, our God, drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people and give it forever to the descendants of Abraham, your friend? It's obviously not to ask the question. They know the answer. The point of the rhetorical question is it's a way of indicating praise by showing that they are absolutely certain that this is the case. And what is their certainty rooted in regard to this? Well, it's rooted into what God had said that He would do. You catch the language there of referring to Abraham, your friend, which takes you back to Genesis chapter 18 when God promised that He would drive out the inhabitants of the land before the descendants of Abraham. When He promised Abraham He would give him that land, it makes you think of Joshua, where that same promise is given to him, or the similar promise that's given to Moses. Verse 9 then is really on top of the hearkening back to Abraham and to Moses and to Joshua. Verse 9 sounds a whole lot like some of the promises that are associated with David. And what it's doing is it's giving really themselves this kind of fresh, renewed kind of assurance of God's commitment to His people and God's commitment to hear the prayer of His people and save them from their distress. And it's the same kind of thing we've been noting just about every week as we look at these different prayers, that these people are taking their stand on God's promises. God has said, I will do this. God has assured them of this. And so what better place is there for them to stand than on what God has told them that He is going to do? And that's what we see them doing here as well. And if anything, with Jehoshaphat, it's even more emphasized. While there's not the exact kind of quotation of God's promises that you find in Moses' prayer or among others, you find just the reference to Abraham, the allusions back to Moses and Joshua, the similar language of the covenant to David. And it's clear that Jehoshaphat is very well versed in the promises of God, and that's where he is taking his stand. That's where his confidence is that what God has promised, God is going to be able to deliver. And so from there, he turns his focus then to the complaint against the invaders in verses 10 and 11. And this is pretty typical lament. If you look through some of the Psalms of Lamentation, you find this kind of language that Jehoshaphat is using a whole lot. If you read people who analyze the biblical text for a living and write books about it, they will tell you that this prayer is a prayer of national lament. And you find some psalms of that as well, where the king is lamenting some situation on behalf of the people. Sounds a whole lot like this prayer. And basically what he's doing is he's describing his problem in very plain terms. And it's an expression of frustration. Jehoshaphat is here looking at these people and looking at the history of his people in relation to these people. And even there may be some kind of implied accusation, blame, or the words that are coming to my mind. And that's really too strong of a term for what I'm thinking. But considering that God is allowing this to happen, what he's saying is, you know, look at our history with this people. You told us not to invade them, and so we didn't. We did what you told us to do. We did what was right by them. And what is happening to us now? Well, they're invading us. they're not treating us right. And again, there may be the implication there that you're allowing this to happen even though we've obeyed you in this regard. I mean, obviously he's not pointing fingers at God and accusing God of anything. But I think the fact that he says, this is what you commanded us to do and we didn't do it, lays at least an implied responsibility on God to deliver us from the situation now, because we've done what was right and what you've commanded us to do. So now deliver us, that they're doing the wrong to us. The implication, of course, of all of this is that we're innocent in regard to what they're doing to us. Now, whether the nation is innocent of everything and they don't deserve judgment, that's another completely different issue. But within the context of the prayer, what he's saying is we're innocent of them invading us because we didn't invade them, is the kind of the rhetorical point that he is making there in this complaint. And it ends then with this plea for help. And what's striking about it is that in this plea, he doesn't ask for anything specific. He asks generally for God to execute judgment on them, but there's no specific idea of what he has in mind. It's not like some of the imprecatory psalms, the psalms where the psalmist calls down a curse on somebody and asks for very specific kinds of things. There's nothing like that. He's praying for deliverance in general, but not specific. The basic idea is he wants God to show his power in this regard, to judge those who have challenged God's purposes. And again, the whole picture of this back history, this back story, the references to Abraham and to David and to Moses and all of that, really spells out that he's talking about God's purposes and God's plans and God's promises. And these people are trying to thwart all of that, and so you've got to do something to solve that. And of course, it's a prayer of humble faith as well here. The picture at the end, the very last thing he says in this prayer is to me just extremely striking, and it's extremely powerful. And it's the kind of thing that we probably should be praying more often than we do. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. It's a complete admission that we are utterly helpless without God. That we understand that the way that seems right to man is not necessarily the right way. That it's not within us to direct our own steps. And all of those other kinds of biblical principles that you find all over the Bible that say the same kind of thing. And that's exactly what Jehoshaphat is acknowledging here, specifically within the context of this invasion. We don't know what to do. We're completely helpless. We have no hope whatsoever to get out of this, but what we do know is that you are there and that that is what we're going to focus on. We don't know what to do, but we are looking to you for an answer, for our salvation, because that's the only place we can look. And ultimately, what you find here is, again, the same principle that you find all over the Bible. You really find it spelled out in some of Paul's writings in the New Testament, and that is to recognize your weakness is the position of greatest strength that you're ever going to find. It's when you're weak, that's when God can make you strong. It's when you're humble, that's when God can lift you up. It's when you don't know what to do, but you look to God, that you will find the greatest deliverance of your life. And that's really the picture that is here, and that's what you find happening as well. They're hopeless. They're helpless. They're weak. They have no hope whatsoever at winning this battle, but God doesn't care. God doesn't need their help whatsoever. And so rather than telling them, you know, you better come up with some kind of plan that I can help you with somehow, it's not at all like the situation of Gideon where God uses their plan and their working, or God gives them a plan or whatever else the case may be. He tells them to just stand there. Go out and encounter them. But what's going to happen is when they go out and they encounter them, they're going to find that they're already dead. The bodies are scattered all over the valley as soon as they get there. But all they have to do is show faith in God and go out and do what they are supposed to do. And God will take care of it all together. And that's what he says. The battle is not yours, but it's God's in verse 15. And then verse 17, you will not need to fight in this battle. Stand firm, hold your position, and see the salvation of the Lord on your behalf. And again, it is this complete picture of God doing what needs to be done as long as they have confidence. And it's a reminder, again, of the kind of thing that we've said before, God doesn't need your help in order to help you. I understand what people mean when they say God helps those who help themselves, and to some degree that is true. And in some situations, that's kind of the biblical picture. But there are plenty of other places where God helps those who stand still and trust in Him and don't do anything. God helps those who realize they are utterly helpless to help themselves and put their confidence in Him instead. And this is one of those places that makes that point very specifically. Barry.
Just think how much a difference that would have made with so many other kings if they would put their confidence in God like Jehoshaphat does, because so many of the other ones, when they would get into this situation, suddenly they'd be, who can we align with? What other nation can we look to save us from this situation? And this one is just inspiring to see that if you do put your trust in God, He will come through. And what I appreciate is the way He humbles Himself, and the response is immediate from God. He immediately says, I'm going to take care of this.
And I wonder also if this is kind of the lesson that he learned from his previous alliance with Ahab. That he gets into that alliance, they go to war, Ahab dies, Jehoshaphat's in a bad spot, and God delivers him when he cries out to him. And so this time, he doesn't make that same mistake. He doesn't go looking for an ally, he just puts his trust in God.
I thought this sounded really familiar, and it turns out it is in Exodus as well, with the crossing of the Red Sea.
Yeah.
And Moses said it, and it's almost word for word what he says, just stand firm. Didn't say what was going to happen. They just had to have faith in order to witness God bringing them salvation.
Yeah, and that's an example that I've used before, and I thought of it here as well, that it's another one of those pictures of God working for the salvation of His people. God doesn't say, you better start building some boats and get to paddling. He says, stand still and watch the salvation that I bring. Moses, of course, is the messenger of that, and they have to walk through. I mean, God doesn't transport them, so there's something that they are doing in the process. There's something that they're doing here as well. So that's not to say that faith is this mere mental assent that doesn't require any action whatsoever. Obviously, that's not the point I'm making. But that, no matter how firmly you believe, no matter how many good things you do, it is all about the power of God and what God is doing that is going to result in any kind of salvation, whether it is salvation from the Egyptians, salvation from this group of people, or salvation from our sins. The picture is the same in every place. Shane?
Scientific explanation. I mean, walking around the city, so many times, and then shouting doesn't, typically make walls fall down. But they had to do that. That was a little more extensive. Gideon's example that you brought up. I mean, those types of things wouldn't normally, cause an army to begin, attacking itself, because 300 people, shine these lights. I mean, it makes for great storyline in the Bible, but all these things are things that God makes them participate in, and He expects us to do certain things too. I mean, we can't sit by and say, "Well,
yeah.
I'm seeking You, so I don't have to go to work now, so you can feed me, because I'm seeking You first."
Right. And ultimately, I mean, even those examples. The kinds of things that God calls on people to do, it shows that God requires their participation. It shows that God requires their obedience, and that faith is more, again, than just mental assent. But it also shows that God's the one who's in control. Because like you said, I mean, walking around a city is not going to make the walls fall down. Breaking open your lights and blowing some trumpets isn't going to win a war. Going underwater and coming back up isn't going to remove all of your moral failings. It's God that does that through your faith in what he is asking you to do. And the power is with God. You participate in it through obedience and submission to God. But none of that is ever about earning salvation and war, or earning salvation from sins or anything else. And so that's the balance that we have to keep in mind, that it does require complete faith. And that's kind of the linchpin of the whole thing, is having the faith in the process, but you've got to do it too. Believing that being baptized is going to take away your sin isn't going to help unless you're baptized, or going to war, or whatever else the case may be.
Well, and beyond that, the further point of talking about God's power, the fact that the things that we do, there's no question about it that it's God's power that's doing it. So the man can't say, well, I fulfilled this, and so we earned this defeat at Jericho. We earned this defeat here. We did it because of our, great whatever. And even in our own, lives today, I mean, there's things that, we can't explain other than to, attribute to God. But in these examples, God always wanted their participation, but the participation is in a way that it still leaves no question that God was... was in control. I mean, when Abraham, had Isaac, there's no question because of his age that, that God was working there.
Yeah.
And just so many different things. They still had to do, but there was no question that God was the power behind it.
Travis?
Even to do these things in the first place is like an acknowledgement of God being God being in control, because the Israelites think walk around the city a few times, and even we might think, dip yourself in some water. Like, God seems to work it that way, where the things he asks of us, maybe this is just the other side of the same point you were just talking about, but it's almost like even agreeing to do it in the first place takes some concession that God's going to do this, that I'm giving it to God.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That it's, on the one hand, it shows God's power. On the other hand, it shows your acknowledgement of God's power being what is all-sufficient in that regard. All right, well, we need to move along. We're running a little bit shorter on time than I thought we were going to. And get to what we're ultimately trying to get out of these prayers, at least for the purpose of this class, and that is, what do we learn from it, from this prayer in particular, that we can apply to us today? So I'll open it up to start, Shane.
Well, I think one of the last bullet points that you had before was his plea was not specific.
Okay.
Leave it to God to decide how he's going to solve our issues. Because sometimes we want to impose our will onto God to say, this is what I want, make this happen, and that may not be what we really need. And so it's best when we can leave it to God and let him solve it the way that he sees it.
Yeah. Pray for deliverance, pray for salvation, but pray leaving it in the hands of God. That your prayer is for his power and his justice to be executed, not necessarily as you see fit, but knowing that he knows best. Let me go ahead and put up a couple of other things that we've talked about a whole lot in this class already. Obviously, there's the place of praise in this prayer. That's praise at the outset, and so praise is obviously appropriate. In particular, as we've seen several times, and we will continue to see as well, and as we look at other prayers, praise is where the prayer starts. Just about every one of these prayers that we've seen begins with the person putting God in his proper context and himself, that the prayer in his proper context as well. It begins with prayer, as so many of the others do. And as we've said already, the prayer is based on the promises of God. It's rooted in the history of the relationship that God has with his people. He seems to quote David, or at least is familiar with David's prayer, very similar to what Solomon says in 2 Chronicles chapter 6 about other nations coming in and turning to God at the temple, and God will deliver them. So probably that's an allusion back to Solomon's 2 Chronicles 6 prayer at the dedication of the temple. Of course, he refers back to the time of Joshua, to Abraham. He alludes to the Abrahamic, the Mosaic, and the Davidic covenants. And ultimately, this is all his conviction that our God now in Jehoshaphat's day and the God of our fathers are one and the same. The reported words and deeds of God are true. Those things actually happened, and that we can expect to see God's good deeds repeated in our own time of need. In prayer, what you find is that the facts of the past and the facts of the present come together. We can have confidence that God will deliver us because God has always delivered His people in their time of need. And that's what you find here. That's what you find as he's referring back to all of this history. And that's what you find then in the context of Jehoshaphat's own faithfulness as well to God in chapter 17, chapter 19, now as he's turning to God again, and then the faith that he is going to exhibit later on as well. He's confident that my God is the same God as the God of my fathers. And for us today, our God is the same as Jehoshaphat's God and the same as Abraham's God. And what God did for Abraham and David and Moses and Joshua and Jehoshaphat and Jesus and Paul and on down the lines, God will do that for His people now as well. And so in prayer, the past and the present come together because it is all ultimately the same to God anyway. That God is a God of deliverance for His people. As I mentioned as we were going through this, that you find a picture of this being a thoughtful kind of prayer. It's an appropriate kind of prayer given the circumstances. The praise that he gives God is tailored to his need, so to speak. And again, that's not to say that he's buttering God up so he's going to get what he wants, as much as it is painting a picture of a man who knows what his situation is, knows who his God is, and appropriately praising God for the things that God has done in relation to his own current circumstance. It's thoughtful. He's not just, you know, blabbering out a rote prayer, saying all the ritual praises that they always say. He's not just quoting, you know, the top five psalms of praise that he knows. He's praying out of his heart based on his circumstances, and he's clearly thought about it. And that's obviously a very good kind of lesson to learn as well. Well, I'll stop for a second. Anything else that others have to say? Greg?
There's something you said at the beginning, but you sort of correct me. You said at the beginning of the praise, and then you talked about how his relationship with God and the right place and him in the right place. It begins with that humility, I think, and understanding that he begins with where he ends up. He ends up saying, we can't do this.
Yeah.
We need to. He actually was there already. It's just that that was really the precursor to this.
Right. And praise and humility go hand in hand. It's kind of hard to say which one goes first because you're not going to praise the way you ought to unless you're humble, and you're not going to be humble the way you ought unless you understand who God is and are praising Him. So certainly the humility is there at the outset. A lot of times you see them together. You see it beginning with praise and immediately turning to the prayer's own humility, or you see it beginning with humility and then immediately turning to praise. This one's a little bit different, at least in terms of the explicit statements of them, because it does begin more explicitly with praise, and the humility doesn't come to the very end. But that's, again, like you're saying, that kind of brackets the whole prayer, this same picture of God being the one in control and us being the one who need to, you know, put Him on His throne, so to speak, in our own hearts. What else? A couple minutes left. Yeah.
It's interesting to look and see that even though he's humble and he understands that he needs God, there is still a boldness in his coming before God and pointing out, you know, he keeps saying, are you not God?
Yeah.
And he keeps reminding him, going back to the promises, keeps reminding him of the promises and saying, you said you would help us. And he's not, you know, obviously it's not in a disrespectful way, there is still that humility there, but he still has a boldness and a to go and speak to God and say, you know, please bring your promises on us.
Yeah, there is definitely confidence in his approach to God. And that's, again, as we've seen in other prayers, that's what you see in these prayers. They go to God in confidence, and the reason they can have confidence is because they're praying based on what God has promised. I mean, how can you not have confidence that God is going to do something when He's already promised to do it? And that's, again, that's where probably, at least in my own life, my prayer life needs to make the biggest shift is to knowing better what God has promised He is going to do in my life and living my life based on what He has already promised. Because when I do that, I've submitted to His will. And I can't do anything but pray according to His will if my life is rooted in what God has promised He is going to do, and my prayer life is rooted in what God has promised that He is going to do. At that point, praying according to the will of God becomes very easy. And that's why you can also have that kind of confidence. And you go when you go to God and you see that confidence as well. Verse 20, they rose early in the morning and went out to the wilderness of Tekoa. That phrase, rise early in the morning, that's a very common biblical phrase that you see when someone is facing a tough task with a certain kind of resolution. You see it in the book of Genesis several times. The one that comes to my mind, or two that come to my mind, after God has promised He's going to destroy Sodom, Abraham rises early in the morning to see what has happened. And then when God tells him to take his son and sacrifice him, he rises early in the morning to complete that task. And you find that over and over and over, people facing these tough tasks by rising first thing in the morning to go meet it head on. And then what he says is, believe in God and you will be established. Believe in His prophets and you will succeed. There is confidence that God is going to do what He has prayed for them to do. So to wrap it up, with what I've got, you see God's power, of course, in their time of dire distress. God doesn't need their help. God will use whatever He wants them to do. But this is all about God's power. Completely and thoroughly, unequivocally, this is about God's power and what God can do to save them. Of course, there is the petition of humble faith. Even the most powerful men in the world, even the kings, have to learn this. And obviously, we must as well. And to humble oneself before God in the face of insurmountable odds, to trust Him fully for deliverance is really the essence of biblical faith. That's what biblical faith is all about, is humbling yourself before God and trusting Him for the deliverance that you're going to find. And then, as we were just saying, confidence in God's answer, that He is going to fulfill, that He is going to do what He has promised to do. Well, we'll stop there for today. Next time, I think we're up to Hezekiah, which is backward in your Bible, but later in the timeline. That'll be 2 Kings chapter 19, if you want to do some reading in advance.